Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon. We've been making our way through the Sermon on the Mount, and this is Jesus' world-changing, world-rescuing game A and you. Now, this is a diagram of the Sermon on the Mount on one side, and then a list of some of the subjects on the other. And one of the things that I wanted us to see early on with the structure is that there's some parallelism going on. And the Lord's Prayer stands at the center of the sermon. And then this righteousness before God that we've looked at for the last 3 weeks is kind of a three-part thing. Righteousness before God in terms of not giving your money away for people to see, not praying in a way for people to see, not fasting or submitting yourself or disciplining yourself in a way for people to see. And so we've done that center of it. Now we move back out again. And this part of the sermon has the parallel of what this particular commentator calls the antithesis. It's when Jesus says, "You have heard it said, but I tell you," that part of the sermon. And that part of the sermon begins with this conversation about righteousness. "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets," that's the Old Testament. "I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But those who practice and teach these commandments will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." And from there, Jesus goes into a section where he treats select elements of the law in a very special way. Jesus, in a sense, deconstructs your self-salvation strategy for saving your soul. It basically says that you cannot save your soul by external conformity to the law. Are you avoiding murder? Good for you. How's your anger? Are you avoiding adultery? Good for you. Talk to me about your lust. Do you keep your sexual life legal? Good for you. What about your marriage? Do you only hit back? Well, good for you. Why are you hitting back? See, he digs into these things at a deeper level, and he, of course, concludes this section with, "Be perfect like your heavenly Father, who causes it to rain and the sun to shine on the just and the unjust. His perfection is in his generosity." Now, Jesus lays out that moral law there, but some of you will say, "But I don't believe in an afterlife. I believe that when I die, I'm done, and so..." But that doesn't mean I'm immoral. I still don't murder. I still don't lie. I still don't commit adultery. Or if I do these things, I have some good justification, at least in my own eyes or in the eyes of the opinions of the people that I care about. Atheists are naturally very concerned about being seen as good people and as moral. And you can find a lot of YouTube videos where, you know, "This is what happens when you raise your kids with no religion." Well, teach them to be empathetic. Teach them to be moral. Teach them to do what's right in the eyes of others. Well, they don't murder. They don't steal. They try to keep their sex legal. The immaterial form of their righteousness is in many ways in sort of the collective subjective, or maybe just to satisfy themselves. Spiritual, as they would call it, would be the interrelational for them. Because, well, it gets a little hard to ask the question, well, what is moving the matter if the matter isn't moving itself? But again, Jesus comes in there and says, "Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you'll have no reward for your father from your Father in heaven." And again, an atheist would say, "Well, I don't care about that aspect of it. So go ahead and show your virtue publicly." See, it gets difficult. Now, what we see is that basically this gets compressed into two dimensions. You have the reputational dimension and you have the material dimension. And now Jesus is going to address the material dimension, Because if you're a materialist, if you say that there is no God and there's nothing after death and all that we are doing right now is having the experience that a conscious being should have, well, what does that mean about the good? What really is important? Jesus continues with a very famous passage. That might sound very familiar to you. And what's sort of interesting about this passage is that even Christians are going to feel a little uncomfortable about this. And so we're going to have to do a little bit of exegetical work in talking about the language of the passage. Most traditional translations will say something like, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and vermin destroy, or moth and rust consume, and where the thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." Now again, if you're an atheist, well, what are you going to do with this? How do you store up treasure in heaven? Do you store up your treasure relationally? Now, I wanted to take a little closer look at the language before translation of this, because the two words, store and treasure, in Greek are really the same word. And so thinking about what's an English word that, and of course the Greek is, you can take that Greek in the New Testament and compare it to the first century translation of the first century BC translation of the Old Testament into Greek that was done in Alexandria called the Septuagint, and get an idea for what the Hebrew scholars believed best fit with that word. And the word is very much like heaping up. So if you're living in an agricultural society, you would heap up your stores of grain or multiply your stores of sheep. Or if it was gold or silver, you would pile up in your treasure room your stores of treasure. And so that word very much means to store up, to heap up. And so I thought maybe heap would be a word that would sort of play with our filters a little bit and get us thinking in a fresh way about this verse. So I did my own little translation of it. "Do not heap up for yourselves heaps on earth." And that really gets visual. "Where moth and vermin destroy." Now the New Testament translators are sometimes rust, and really the word there is sort of eating. So then they try and get little animal images in there. But the idea is quite simple. If you had a pile of grain, well, the vermin would get in and eat the grain. If you had a pile of clothing was a very big indicator of wealth in the ancient world. Well, moths would come and eat the clothing. And so your heaps of clothing or grain or whatever it is you value and whatever it is you sort of put your trust in terms of holding value in this world, Jesus says, don't store it up here on earth because it gets eaten away. But heap up for yourselves heaps in heaven. And then you think, what would I heap up in heaven? "Where moths and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your heaps are, there your heart will be also." And again, the reason I use heaps is because you sort of have this picture of working all the time in the field to bring in this grain, working all the time in the market to buy this fancy clothing, to accumulate this gold. And so where your heap is, now we're using a location image here, where your heap is, that's what you think about. How's my 401k doing? The next passage is again a little bit of a difficult passage, and partly because the theory about how eyesight worked in the ancient world was a little different from us. The eye is the lamp of the body, and now that sounds strange in English, but it made perfect sense to the original listeners because the idea was sort of like the eyes are the lamps of the body in the way that your headlamps or your headlights are the lamps of the car. Okay? And you see this with someone who has bright eyes or their eyes were shining. I mean, these are very common ways of understanding eyes. But then, because this is different for us, a lot of translators try to mess around with the translation to make it intelligible in English. But I did a little translation that will sort of keep the words there, even though they're difficult for us to understand. Therefore, if your eye is single or simple, and if you look at some old translations, you'll find those words used, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is evil, your whole body will be dark. Therefore, if the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? And again, this is a very confusing passage for many. And to the best that I can find, and you're going to, if you look at a whole bunch of commentaries, you'll see a whole bunch of Bible scholars with all different takes on this passage, but I'll give you my take, that the question is whether your insides and your outsides will be the same. The Old Testament places, and the New Testament places, a great deal of criticism on duplicity. That would be the opposite of what we would call integrity. And there could be in this passage a sense that if inside you are good, you will see the good out there. But if inside you are dark, well, everything is dark. And probably many of you have known that. There could be a connotation here, or maybe I'm just putting it on there here, of cynicism. And those who have what we might say in English, those who cast a cynical eye, well, everything they see is darkness. And those who, perhaps in a Pollyannish way, are looking out with good intent, well, the world looks much better. But what's critical here is the capacity of the eye, it seems, to keep things open. Are you single-minded or are you duplicitous and evil? And now we're leveraging this because of the passage before is fairly easy to understand, heaping up for yourself treasures in earth, and the passage that after is right along with the first one, and so it seems to be a question of a double face or a double heart or a single-minded life. Because in this world, we're always torn between two things, heaven and earth often. So no one is able to serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You are not able to serve God and then what happens, again, if you read an old translation, they'll use a loan word all the way from Aramaic, which was the common language that was spoken when Jesus was teaching. The loan word was mammon, mamona. Well, what is mamona? Well, actually, it's pretty close to heaps. And so if we go back and we look at don't heap up for yourself treasures on earth where the eaters eat it or the thieves break in and steal it when it comes to the gold, the things that eaters don't eat, but heap up for yourself treasures in heaven where there are no moths and eaters to eat it and where there's no thieves that break in and steal, for where your heaps are, there will your heart be. And the state of your heart very much is connected in terms of what you see around you and what you see going on. So if it's darkness inside, how great that darkness is, because there's plenty of darkness in the world. You can't serve two masters. You will love the one and hate the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. And so you have to choose. Is it going to be God, or is it going to be your heaps? Now, most contemporary translations will choose money. And money isn't a bad translation because, in many ways, because piles of grain get eaten by vermin and clothing gets eaten by moths and gold is stolen by thieves, we have used a thing that's fairly immune to decay. It's really an idea, which is dollars. I mean, show me a dollar. Well, you might say, well, here's a dollar bill. But you know as well as I do, this is sort of just a sacrament of a dollar. That you have, you know, if you have $1,000 in the bank, it doesn't mean there's a little box in the bank with 1,000 of these, one stacked up on top of the other. Dollars are completely fictitious. They're not subject to decay, like gold is not subject to decay, but they are subject to theft. And so, well, what is Jesus getting at here? He is, again, mostly talking about your heart. But he's not done. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? Now, many people in reading this passage have noted, I find dead birds all the time. Yeah. We do die like the birds, don't we? Yeah. The point of this passage is not that, well, somehow if you're religious and you trust in God, then you won't have anything to worry about. The point of this passage, as with the previous passage before it, is all about the concerns of your heart. Where is your heart? That's the question. Your life is finite. You will die like the birds of the air, like the grass of the fields, and its place remembers it no more. The Old Testament is very clear on this. But your worry about it, does that really add to your life? Well, what exactly is your life? And why do you worry about your clothes, those things that moth eats? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. Clothing was a very big deal in the ancient world. Most people had one set of clothing to wear, and so your status in society was very much communicated by the clothing you wear. Still is today, but not to the degree it was there. If this is how God clothes the grass of the field, which are worth nothing, cows eat it, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? So what's he getting at with this worry? Well, the same thing he's getting at earlier with the concerns of the heart and the heaping. Did you select the factors that govern the beauty of your adornments? Because the truth is, you didn't choose your parents or your genetics, and in many ways your social status was determined by to whom you were born and where you were born and all these sorts of things. The nation, the century, the class, you didn't choose any of these things. You didn't choose whether or not you'd live during a pandemic. Surprise! Here we are. A war, a famine, a depression. Yeah, the birds of the air and the flowers of the field. They're pretty finite. Yet, you sit here and you wring your hands and you worry and you worry and you worry. You didn't choose any of this. Jesus is basically telling you, you're pretty small. Do not worry saying, what shall we eat or what shall we drink? What shall we wear? For the, and here again a Greek word, the ethne. You know, a lot of Bibles will translate it pagans. It's a much older, that's coming from the Latin really. Because if you say the nations, what it means is that you're talking about the Jewish people, and then you're talking about the goy, the people who are the nations, the ethne of the world, the people who don't believe in God. Well, why do they work this way? If you remember some of the things I've talked about in terms of the meta-divine realm, that the common pagan and even materialist conception of the world is that this world is just this impersonal place, and it's up to you and your power to make life work. And if you fail at it, well, then you're lost. But that's not the story of the Bible. That's not the story of the people of God according to the Old Testament and then the New Testament. No, you might suffer and you will die, but you are in God's hands and he is choosing for you. It's not so much just simply left up to you. The ethne, the nations, they run after these things. But your Father in heaven knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry, again, back to the worry, about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble on its own. And again, the point here is, every day is going to have trouble. Birds die. Flowers fade. Cows eat it. It's thrown into the fire. Yeah, so with the atheists, yeah, we are fodder for the age of decay. But how do you think about it? How do you approach it? How much heaping, now this heaping again is a very anxious heaping, how much anxious heaping will you do? You see, oh, now I'm covering up. Okay, the nations. Whoops. The nations seek their reputation and their lives. It's all up to them, so you'd better worry. Even they'll tell you it's probably not a good idea. You'll burn through your autonomic nervous system and die young, ironically. Worrying doesn't, in fact, add any days to your life. Worrying takes them away. And Jesus teaches, consider your reputation with God, an audience of one. Don't worry about what you can't control. Live freely, trusting in your Father in heaven. Now you get the two sets of the parallels here in the sermon. Now, you might say, I'd love to tell you what you want to hear. That maybe it's all up to you because you trust yourself. Or maybe you don't trust yourself at all, and so it's all just up to God and you have nothing to do in life. Well, that's not true either. Jesus gives plenty of admonitions that somehow it's you're able to secure your own righteousness, your own moral standing with God and the community, that you're able to secure your physical welfare and your pleasure. That's natural, but it's a fantasy, and it's a fantasy that is borne out every time you see someone who, by virtue of how they were born or where they were born, simply have their entire life stacked against them. Maybe they're born with a birth defect and they die young. Maybe they're born at the bottom of a social heap and they never get to climb out. Maybe they were born at the wrong time and everything was against them. Maybe they just arrived at the flower of their youth and they got drafted into a war and they died a senseless death on some faraway beach. Yeah, the birds of the air fall one after another. The message here isn't, well, you know, religion will make you wealthy and happy and satisfied. You're not in control of your moral quality near to the degree that you imagine. Oh, congratulations, you haven't murdered anyone. Talk to me about the bitterness in your heart. Oh, congratulations, you haven't slept around. Talk to me about how you think about the others. Talk to me about your divorce, about your oath-taking, your yes be yes and your no be no, and the vengeance that you just nurse in your heart. Do you have that generosity that even we as a culture admire? So don't live your life heaping up. It's not the way life is supposed to work. Don't live your life heaping up because you can't plan your life. You have one master. God is good, so trust him. It doesn't mean you won't die young. Don't be anxious. Look at nature. Your Father in heaven knows what you need. So seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Now, I would love to stop the sermon here because this is an easy place to stop, but the application of this gets hard, as many of you know. Is savings for retirement against Jesus' command? Can I realistically stop worrying? I'm anxious all the time, and now with COVID, it's all around me. Is money evil? What does it mean to seek his kingdom and his righteousness? Why are there two things and not one? Now, I can do a whole sermon series just on these things, but I'm not going to. So I'll give a little bit of wisdom. Why is Jesus talking about money in this way, or mammon, or heaping? Well, Jesus had a very interesting relationship with money. Clearly, he wasn't a wealthy man. He didn't own vast amounts of property, but he wasn't destitute either. He had at least a piece of clothing that the Roman soldiers saw fit to not divide up, so they cast lots for it. He relied on the generosity of wealthy people for his food and his lodging, although for the first 30 years of his life, it seems, he worked for his own to sustain himself. So the point here isn't money is bad, and the point here isn't be responsible with your money. Money seems almost incidental to Jesus. He understands its conceits, and he understands its importance. But it's the heaping up, it's the disposition of the heart that's seen in the heaping and the worrying that Jesus says to his disciples, don't do it. There's no life there. That's what the ethne, that's what the nations chase after, and it goes away. Jesus is most concerned with how it grips our hearts. Where your heap is, there is where your heart is. So first, we should begin by understanding our smallness. So much of your life is chosen for you by others in the flow of history. You are responsible for what you do with the opportunities and the challenges. So go for it. But that's a very different attitude than I'm working my heap. I'm working my heap. The eulogy virtues versus the resume virtues. And I've often found this. David Brooks introduced it to me in his book, The Road to Character. We have these resume virtues where we're heaping up things. We're heaping up things on our resume. We're heaping up our degrees. We're heaping up the impressive job titles we've had. We're heaping up the accomplishments out there in the world. But really, on your deathbed, is this what you ponder? And I've seen this dealt with in movies. The Razor's Edge, one of my favorite movies from the 80s. The one guy who lived his whole life worrying about what everybody thought of him, worrying about his money, his estate, all of these things. Is that what matters when he's dying? This isn't hard to know. Pretty much almost everybody knows this, whether or not you believe in God. What do you really care about for those you love? Where is your heart really? Yes, you want people to be secure, happy, and comfortable. It is many times when it's often the man who dies before the woman in a marriage. And my friend will look at me and, will you look after my wife? Yes, we'll keep an eye on your wife. And so they're worried about their loved ones. Do they want them to live fabulously wealthy? No, will they be secure, comfortable, happy? Yes. But once sort of the minimum requirement is met, nobody on their deathbed says, I wished I worked more time in the office. I wish I spent more time heaping. Look at what Jesus says, that kingdom righteousness. What is he getting after? Is there peace among the children? Are past divisions reconciled? Will the broken be mended? Will the world be mended? Have I done right by this world? And my God, how did I use my time and treasure? Your heart is not on the treasure or the time. The heart is on the goal of what you're using these things for. Towards what end? A lot of talk about this game B. What if everybody in the world lived this way? In many ways, when I listen to the concerns that individuals who talk about game B have, these are their concerns. We're not far off on that score. Less anxious, less workaholism, fewer barn builders. The best illustration of Jesus' teaching, I think, comes from Jesus. Someone in the crowd said to the teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Have you ever seen a family squabble over inheritance money? Jesus replied, man, who appointed me as judge and arbiter over you? Classic Jesus move. Then he said to them, talking to the crowd, watch out. Be guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. Life does not consist in heaping up. And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest, he thought to himself. Now, again, who made this ground fertile? Did the Lord bring the rain? Did the Lord bring the sun? It was all a gift. And boom, suddenly he's a wealthy man. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. I have no place for my heaps. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. Now, again, the Bible isn't against barn building. Read the story of Joseph. Joseph says, we're going to have 7 fat years and 7 lean years. So build big barns and we'll feed the world. And Joseph is an Old Testament picture of Jesus. It's the next move. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain to live up, to lade up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. Ah, there it is. There it is. The center of his heart. But God said to him, you fool. You fool. This very night, your life will be demanded of you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God.